Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host this morning, and Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. You'll hear Patricia's voice a lot during today's program. Do you know where you were 21 years ago today, November 30th, 1999? For at least some of our listeners, the answer is Seattle. November 30th, 1999 was the start of protests against the World Trade Organization, the WTO. The days of street action against corporate-dominated globalization designed to bypass any possibility of democratic oversight or control. Yet another manifestation of voter suppression, if you will. This morning's program has an environmental activist theme. I'll talk with Patricia on the fascinating topic of citizen scientists, who these people are, why they're necessary. And Bill Resnick will talk with Kathy Becker on the successful campaign in Columbus, Ohio, to get a public agency to take over supplying electricity to the city. But the WTO protests also fit our environmental theme. You'll remember the slogan, Teamsters and Turtles Together. And I want to take a couple of minutes to reflect on what those protests accomplished. They stopped the WTO in its tracks and inspired similar mass actions wherever else in the world that anti-democratic organization tried to meet. They had a strong impact here in Portland. Mobilizing for Seattle brought thousands of people together in rallies and teach-ins here. I remember addressing a standing-room-only audience in Portland State University's largest auditorium. Jobs with Justice and other organizations sent up 3 busloads, if memory serves, as well as numerous cars. Just 5 months later, numerous groups relaunched May Day in Portland, and a couple thousand people celebrated solidarity in the streets, defying militarized attacks by the police that led ultimately to a series of community meetings and the firing of Police Chief Mark Croker. Coming out of its own extensive participation in Seattle, the labor movement was reinvigorated. Labor meetings had an air of excitement and possibility, and no longer assumed the bland continuance of capitalist domination. Riding that wave, workers at Powell's Books not only successfully organized, but got their first contract. The next year, on May Day in Portland, the city council stepped in and bought for us the permit we refused to ask for, and thousands marched openly and joyously. We were part of a worldwide, growing movement. Our closet at home still holds souvenirs of Seattle, November 30th, like a rubber bullet fired by police that our 13-year-old son brought home. Here, briefly, are a couple of extracts from an essay Alex Diamond published at the time in an anthology called Voices from the WTO. Patricia will read them.
As a 13-year-old who participated in the WTO protests, I enjoyed a rather unique experience. I am not sure why I initially decided to bus to Seattle. The momentousness of the occasion allured me, as did the adventure and excitement. In many ways, typical to teenagers, I was also trying to show my independence. The issues, of course, were also important to me. The wrongs of the WTO and capitalism in general disturb and enrage me. When I first arrived in Seattle from Portland on the 29th of November with my godfather, I was thinking of the protests as a big adventure, not necessarily something to participate in, but to observe. A day later, busing back to Portland, my outlook had changed completely. I was proud of my role in the nonviolent direct action, and more importantly, what it accomplished. I was inspired and uplifted by the turnout and dedication of protesters. I was filled with hope for an even bigger movement to end capitalism.
Alex was impressed with his fellow activists.
During part of my time in Seattle, I was able to sit back and observe a lot of the protesters. The most interesting thing I noticed was the diversity of people. I noticed this many times. There were people of many different races, creeds, ethnicities, and lifestyles. There were everything from steelworkers, teamsters, environmentalists, anarchists, goths, to even motorcycle gang members, the Hell's Angels. The turnout of protesters from other parts of the world was incredible, especially considering that most protesters weren't rich and couldn't easily afford to make their way to Seattle.
He wrote about his own experience in the streets, what it was like to take and hold positions, even under police attacks, and what it was like to encounter some of the official WTO delegates from small countries who thanked protesters for protecting them from the bullying of the dominant capitalist powers. He concluded earnestly, as a precocious 13-year-old might.
As our bus pulled away later that evening, I reflected on what I had seen and learned and decided that it both scared and excited me. The opportunities for social change in the future seemed to be exceeded only by the need for social change.
That was a great start to our millennium. To keep it going, I turn now to an interview with Patricia Kohlberg on a small but crucial group of activists, people we call citizen scientists. Patricia was medical director of Multnomah County for 20 years. In this first part, we address the age-old question, who watches the watchers? Who regulates the regulators?
The environmental movement has always needed citizen scientists. Back in the late 70s, when I was developing an environmental program for the labor movement here in the Pacific Northwest, there was a lot of science that I had to learn, as well as learning about the different regulatory agencies. I had to learn about, for instance, exposures, limits on exposures, chemicals workers in workplaces were exposed to, as well as the different jurisdictions, the difference between the occupational safety and health agencies, both state and federal, and the environmental protection agencies, both state and federal. The work that I was doing inside the workplace was in some ways simpler than much of the environmental movement on the outside of workplaces. We could see some of the consequences of, for instance, exposures, chemical exposures. When workers were handling pentachlorophenol, when they were working with wood preservatives and their dioxin contaminants, we could directly encounter the exposures, or the consequences rather, neural damage and reproductive damage, and we could intervene and change those practices. And when corporations claimed that they weren't using chemicals, again, that we knew that they were, we could sneak into the back rooms and expose their practices and their lies. Science was part of larger social issues then as it is now. Again, focusing on a workplace when women were barred from certain kinds of jobs because there were potential reproductive consequences for their exposures, we could intervene on grounds of gender discrimination. That is, if there were consequences for women, we knew there were consequences for men also. It was discriminatory to bar women from jobs. In effect, what I was doing was training citizen scientists. And by citizen, I meant two different ways. One is we were not people with science training, and two, we were understanding the science in a larger context, like I mentioned, issues of gender discrimination. Patricia Kohlberg has been both functioning as a citizen scientist and has been intrigued by the phenomenon of citizen scientists surrounding her in the environmental movement. Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg, you've already had some training along the lines of science. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory.
Well, I do have training in both as a physician, and I have a master's in public health, and as part of that, I did do a little bit of environmental training, but I came into this work in the part of the environmental movement that is working against climate change with very little understanding of the kinds of scientific issues that I would be asked to evaluate. I've been working with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've become one of their science writers, which means that I help to read and evaluate usually permits that have been applied for by various fossil fuel corporations to the regulatory agencies like the Department of Ecology in Washington State or Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. What I've noticed is that there are a whole number of people in these communities that have been targeted by the fossil fuel corporations for these big projects like the liquefied natural gas project in Coos Bay or the methane to methanol refinery in Kalama, that there are people within those communities who are dismayed by what they see as a threat to their ways of life or a threat to the climate or their environment. And they have taken it upon themselves to educate themselves about the science of energy, the energy industry, which is very complicated, so that they could effectively challenge these corporations on this very scientific and technical terrain that would occur during the permitting process.
Now, you think of these folks as, leaving yourself out of the question, as kind of heroes.
Well, they are. I mean, many of these people do not have formal scientific training. Some of them do, or some of them, for example, there's a woman in Kalama who has training as a mathematician. That's not the same as understanding the environmental science of the energy industry. It's a whole different field. And people have stepped into realms that are very difficult and technical to grasp.
Just like your medical training didn't equip you probably any more than it would have me to read an environmental impact statement.
No, when I first started looking at methane, you know, understanding the global warming potential of methane, I had to figure out what they were talking about there and what's the difference between the 20-year versus the 100-year global warming potential and why does it matter and why do people use one or the other? And it's confusing. And you have to take time to understand it.
Why? I mean, obviously, why to understand it, but why do we need civilians doing this? Why isn't this part of what the regulatory agencies are doing?
Well, basically, I think because the citizen scientists have had to step up and become the regulatory agencies for the regulatory agencies. We're the ones who are kind of checking on their work because, unfortunately, they have not been doing their job. They've been permitting these large transnational fossil fuel corporations to submit these technical pieces of permitting data which are not scientifically sound, which do not have scientific integrity. And it's fallen to the citizen scientists to reveal that and say, look, this isn't sound science, and you can't go forward with this permit when they're using this outdated metric from 20 years ago. This was updated 5 years ago, and we should be using that metric.
As just one example. I like the notion that citizen scientists are the regulators regulating the regulatory agencies. It's a national phenomenon, of course, this phenomenon of citizen scientists, but especially here in the Pacific Northwest. Why?
We are in the unfortunate position of being targeted by the fossil fuel corporations right now, both oil and gas.
And coal
as well, although we've fought that off. Actually, we've fought off quite a number of projects. We've been very successful. And I attribute a lot of that success to these citizen scientists who have stepped up to the plate. The issue in the Pacific Northwest is that we have abundant water, we have relatively cheap electricity, and we have ready access to overseas, particularly Asian markets. And these are the things that the fossil fuel industry really needs right now.
We know what the regulatory agencies are supposed to be doing. Why aren't they?
I believe that it's primarily political pressure, and it's political pressure that is being purchased by the fossil fuel corporations, not just the fossil fuel corporations, by the timber interests, by the transportation interests, by many large corporations in whose interest it is to put the brakes on any kind of regulation of carbon emissions.
Including by submitting what you've otherwise called junk science. I want to come back to the junk science issue, but focus still on the regulatory agencies. You're talking about direct influence on them by corporations. An indirect influence, of course, would be all the cutbacks in government resources, the resources that those regulatory agencies have. I'm struck by one of the consequences of those cutbacks, as well as of the influence, is how much the regulatory agencies rely on data furnished by precisely the entities, the corporations they're supposed to be regulating. This reminds me, incidentally, of a Grace Paley story where she tells about as a young bride on an army base. She's in charge of the radio station or something like that. And every day at noon, it's her responsibility to set a chime on the radio that will tell people what the exact time. And she does it by looking out the window and seeing the clock that's prominently displayed above the main building in the army base. And one day she finds out that that clock has been set regularly, that the criteria they use for deciding the time as the chime that she puts out over the radio. And so here you get the regulatory agencies regulating the chemical exposure, say, to stick with that kind of an example, based on precisely the data that the corporations are feeding back to them about what's safe.
Right. The usual story is that the corporation that's trying to push a particular project and wants to get these permits hires a firm to do its calculations, its projections, its measurements, and produce the data that will then go into the permit application. But the corporations are the ones who are paying the bill for that. And so they are the client of the agencies that are actually producing the information. So when they produce that information, they're going to produce the information, the data that their client wants to see. But there's even another aspect to that, which is that so much of this data is not even measured. It's actually calculated. For example, they will do these tests on a stack. And maybe they'll do that once a year at a predefined time when the facility knows that it's going to happen, so they can manipulate their production process however they want to do it. They come in, they make that one test, and then they project annual emissions through these mathematical formulas for the entire year. And there isn't any ongoing measurement of what's actually coming out of that stack except for this one time a year.
I remember that particular instance when you mentioned a stack. That's the incinerator.
Yeah.
North of Salem,
right,
along I-5. And you're talking about how DEQ in Oregon supposedly regulates the emissions.
Right.
One time a year, and then we project for what it's going to be like for...
Just to be real precise, there are a few emissions that they measure on a continuous basis. But there are, I don't know, 50, 100 toxic emissions that are spewing out of those stacks. And for all the rest of them, other than five or six of them, they're only doing either no measurements or just that one annual measurement.
We'll resume the interview after this reminder that science is real by They Might Be Giants.
Hello!
Hello!
We are They Might Be Giants.
And we want to welcome you to our musical laboratory. As the philosopher Rudolf Carnap once so clearly said,
science is a system of statements based on direct experience and controlled by experimental verification.
Or as we say, science is real.
Science is real.
In the second part of this interview with Patricia Kohlberg, we talk about the premises and values that underlie science. One other problem that you've pointed to within the regulatory agencies is that when they project into the future, when they think of alternatives, their premises are restricted to just the market itself. They don't take into account that there could be other ways of organizing a society, other ways of dealing with environmental problems. That too is an issue I want to come back to. Before we do that, can you walk us through a particular instance in detail? I have in mind, you've mentioned Kalama, so let's go with that. So here we are looking over an environmental impact statement submitted by the corporation. It's required by law to do that. What happens? What are the problems with it?
The Kalama methane to methanol refinery permitting process is now well into its sixth year. When it first started, they produced an environmental impact statement that had lots of problems with it, but one of the big problems was that they calculated the greenhouse gas emissions based on what the operation would produce just at the site. And of course, this is a big problem because the entire project is responsible for producing way more greenhouse gas emissions than what happens just on the site. And in fact, the calculation that subsequently came out showed that roughly of the total greenhouse gas emissions associated with this methane to methanol refinery, the site itself in Kalama only accounts for about 20% of those greenhouse gas emissions. The rest of it would be associated with the extraction of the gas, the transport, the storage, and then the end use of the product. All those activities produce greenhouse gases. And you can't just count the little bit, you know, that you want to count. It's sort of like saying the donuts that I eat at work don't count because I don't eat them at home, so those calories don't count. Well, that's ridiculous on the face of it. So there was a big fuss made about that, and the company was told it had to go back and produce what we call a life cycle analysis that would take into account all those greenhouse gas emissions. So they did that.
Pause for just an instance to emphasize the point you just made, which is it took mass protests to get them to do that life cycle analysis. And here is where the citizen scientists have an impact.
Yes, precisely. So they came back with their so-called life cycle analysis and made this claim that their operation would actually result in a net reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions. And they managed to produce this so-called scientific result by pulling, you know, two sort of tricks. One is that they used all these outdated metrics.
Like I said, just to cement that image in my mind. So here's a process that's based on fracking and on shipping with all its leakages and on producing methanol.
And plus the end use of the methanol was to make plastic in China.
And all of this is going to have a positive impact on greenhouse gas emissions,
right,
on climate change,
right,
essentially.
Right.
We're contributing,
yes,
to stopping climate change by doing all this.
That's correct.
That's their science showed this.
That, yeah, and the two tricks were using all this junk science to way tamp down on the greenhouse gas emissions, to really undercount. And the second was to use their basis of comparison, a process that was using coal to produce plastics. So they're using the very lowest standard and a process that the world needs to move away from and is moving away from into, I mean, there are alternatives for producing plastic. There are also alternatives in terms of cutting down on the amount of plastic that we need. And you don't need to use as your you shouldn't be using as your standard the absolute worst business as usual kind of scenario. So those were the two kind of tricks they used.
Well, I recall a further trick, actually, which is the difference between how the project was presented to the regulators and to the public and how it was presented to their shareholders.
Yes. They basically were saying, as late as 2019, they were saying to the regulators that this methanol was going to be 100% used in the manufacturing of plastics. It was not going to be diverted for use as a fuel.
Which
in
would
China.
Have even greater environmental impact, if so.
2.6 times more greenhouse
worse.
Gas emissions associated with methanol when it's used as a fuel. So that would really throw their numbers off. So they said, oh, we're not going to permit that to happen. It's only going to be used for plastics. At the same time they were telling regulators this, they were telling their investors there is this burgeoning market for methanol as a fuel in China, and we're going after that market. That information was leaked to Columbia Riverkeeper and published by OPB. Northwest Innovation Works, which is the Chinese company that is trying to build this project, they were the ones that were essentially lying to regulators about their intentions for what they were going to do with the methanol.
Yeah, essentially, it doesn't even need to be said. They were out and out lying. In other words, submit whatever passes for science that's necessary to get the plant built, and then there's nothing anybody can do about it after that. You sell the product how you want and
correct.
To whom you want. And okay, let's look more closely at the science then. What do you mean by junk science?
Well, I mentioned one already, is that you use a metric for the global warming potential of methane that is old and has been updated, and in this case that lowballed the effect of methane by 25%. Another thing that they did was that they applied the 100-year standard instead of the 20-year standard for how to measure the effect. And basically what you're doing is you're saying, you know, this is how much greenhouse gases you're going to put out for the life of the project. Let's spread that out over 100 years instead of over 20 years. And so obviously you do the math, it looks like it's a lot worse if you spread it out over 20 years rather than 100 years.
For our listeners who may not be as math astute, let's take another kind of instance. It occurs to me, I don't know how many houseless people across the country are killed by the police every year. An arbitrary figure, let's say 200 a year. Now, if you measure that in the last 10 years, you get this 200 a year. But suppose we're submitting to regulators and we say, instead, here's our measure, that it's the number of BIPOC houseless people who are killed by police averaged out over recorded history.
Yeah. It's a little more complicated than that, but conceptually that's kind of what it means. And the interesting thing to me is when I dug into this is that both the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the EPA itself cautions against using a 100-year standard for methane, because methane is very short-lived and it's in the atmosphere, and its greenhouse gas effects tend to drop way off after about 12 years. So it just doesn't make any sense to measure it over 100 years.
And you're talking about just the one particular project, but when you talk about junk science, you've encountered this in other instances as well. As a matter of fact, in nearly every corporate submission that I'm aware of that you've researched, you're talking about data that's outdated or that's manipulated or that's cherry-picked or that's just lacking in evidence. All of those passing themselves off as science and being accepted by regulatory agencies for the kinds of reasons we talked about before, which brings us back to these wonderful individuals who spend the effort on behalf of their community to actually do the research as part of mobilizing people. That's what you mean by junk science. Premises by the regulatory agencies to resume continued production of plastics, that's not in question. Continued practices in producing plastic and in producing the materials that go into plastic, as if pretty much we didn't have a climate change issue. And one thing that came up earlier I'd like you to address is just the continued assumption that markets provide the only kind of solution, that this is built in to the science.
Or what passes for science.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, to come back to the Kalama project, what happened after they submitted this greenhouse gas analysis that was so flawed was that the Washington State Department of Ecology kind of threw up its hands and said, all right, we're going to take this over. So they decided to produce their own analysis. And they hired three for-profit engineering and environmental and marketing firms to do this analysis. And their life cycle analysis was actually quite well done. We do not have issues with how they conducted the greenhouse gas life cycle analysis, but they come to the conclusion that this methanol refinery is going to be good for global warming by pulling out one of the same old tricks, which is they're comparing it to coal, as if coal is the only alternative that we have. And that's simply not true. They didn't even look at some of the bio-based feedstocks that can be used to produce plastics, for example. And those are more expensive, but they're also more expensive in the context of a heavily subsidized fossil fuel industry.
And potentially less expensive in terms of environmental impact.
Absolutely. So that was one problem, that same old, this is better than coal, so it's great for global warming. But the other thing that they did that I think was very egregious and disturbing is that once they did the life cycle analysis, then they laid over it this market analysis. And they used these market analyses, basically taking what's happening now in the fossil fuel energy markets, and they project those 40 years into the future, basically without taking anything into consideration very much, like whether there might be ongoing pandemics or whether there might be worldwide economic depression. But to me, the worst of it was that the analysis very explicitly rules out taking into consideration any possible attempts at regulating, for example, phasing out or banning single-use plastics or phasing out fossil fuels. And what that says to me is that the underlying premise here is that the market is the main governing force in human society, and there's nothing we can do about that. And I find that to be a shockingly cynical stand for a regulatory agency to take.
We're having to wrap up at this point. I want to go back to the other concept of citizen scientist, the other part of what we mean by citizen. We focused a lot on the scientific investigation and the dedication of people to learn the science when they don't have that kind of training initially. Science itself doesn't furnish the answers, though, to the kinds of policy questions that really are at stake. The big questions aren't simply science questions. Science plays a role in how we decide, how we move forward. But those questions aren't answered strictly in science terms. And here's the other dimension of citizen in citizen science. Flesh out just a little bit what we mean by that. What are the kind of big questions that science fits into?
Well, science can inform us in when we're trying to make these policy questions, but really, when communities are faced with these big projects, the kinds of questions that I think they are grappling with are questions like, how do we make a decision that is just and fair to everyone? How do we decide how we want to live? How do we want to live with the natural world? What's important to us in terms of our community and the ways that we've chosen to build our community? Those are the kinds of questions that are absolutely crucial to deciding whether we're going to take these projects on. But they're not the kinds of questions that are necessarily answered by science. They can be informed by science, but they can't necessarily tell us how we should exercise our own values, our own beliefs, our own desires about the kinds of communities that we want to be. And sometimes these highly technical arguments and discussions and disputes can be a distraction from that very basic conversation about who do we want to be as a community.
Lastly, we're in suspense. When do we expect the decision on Kalama?
Well, we're expecting the Washington State Department of Ecology to rule on the shoreline permit in early December.
This has been Norm Diamond with citizen scientist Patricia Kohlberg.
Thank you, Norm.
And now, just a smidgen of Science Genius Girl by Freeze Pop.
Genius girl, I want the science fair. I wear a white lab coat, EMS rounds in my hair. When I come, the human being, it will want to hold my hand.
Finally, Bill Resnick talks with Kathy Becker, direct action environmental activist.
Hi, Kathy Colin Becker. Welcome to KABU.
Nice to be here.
Kathy Colin Becker started her career as a journalist, worked at several U.S. papers, developed deep concerns about climate change, that humanity and our system of production and consumption was creating the conditions for our own extinction. Kathy Colin Becker became chair of the Sierra Club's Ready for 100 campaign, asking cities to commit to 100% renewable energy. The campaign was instrumental in gaining overwhelming voter approval for ballot measures in Ohio where a city takes over responsibility to supply electricity. Columbus is the 15th largest city in this country, will create the largest clean energy program in the Midwest. Portland has a magnificently illustrated and beautiful, slick plan, which is not being implemented. But Columbus is taking steps that will make it 100% renewable energy in the next 10 years. Kathy Becker, how did that vote happen in a red state, and how does Columbus plan to do it?
Yeah, I've been running the Ready for 100 campaign in Columbus, in Ohio, for about the past 4 years. We've been talking to the city about making a commitment to 100% renewable energy community-wide, not just along city government. And when we first brought it up several years ago, it was kind of looked at like that's impossible. There's no way to do that. But one program that we've been pushing that would get us a long way in that direction is community choice aggregation. So that is a program that is, it's only legal in 9 states, and Ohio is one. And what it does is it allows cities to negotiate on behalf of their residents and small businesses with utilities to gain a bulk purchase rate for energy. And so there's about 400 cities in Ohio that have already enacted aggregation, most of them not for renewable energy. But Columbus took this a step further. What this means is the city issues a request for proposals to the utilities saying, okay, what price can you give us? And Columbus took it 2 steps further. They said, we want this power through 100% renewable energy, and we want it mostly from local construction of new wind and solar projects. And we want this to generate money for community grants for our low-income neighborhoods. So that's what Columbus put in its RFP. And as you mentioned, Columbus is the largest city in Ohio, the 14th largest in the United States. Ohio is the 6th highest carbon emitting state, so it's really important that Columbus take concrete steps to reduce its carbon emissions. The IPCC says we must cut them in half by 2030. And cities are responsible for 70% of carbon emissions worldwide, which makes sense because, you know, most people live in cities. And the top sources in cities are buildings and transportation. So this will really affect the electricity supply in Columbus coming into homes and residents and just basically most buildings in Columbus. I guess in Ohio, in order to do an aggregation program, you know, you're negotiating on behalf of your residents and businesses, so you have to get approval of the voters to do that. And that's why it went to the ballot. So when Columbus decided to put this aggregation for 100% renewable energy on the ballot, Grove City, which is the largest suburb in Columbus, decided to do the same thing. Ohio, as you said, is a red state now. It used to be much more purple or about half and half, but it's been going more consistently red as a state. Columbus, though, is very Democratic, but Grove City is majority Republican, and yet this ballot initiative passed in both cities, in Columbus by 76% and Grove City by 63%. And so what that says is that this is nonpartisan. People like renewable energy. They understand the need that we have to move to renewables to lower our emissions, to have a sustainable environment, to have a healthier environment without so much air pollution. And then also, because this will be done through local build-out, it's going to create jobs. And Ohio, a lot of cities here are hollowed out by the collapse of manufacturing in the middle class. And this promises to bring some of that back. So this was really something that environmentalists like, that the city likes as workforce development, that the utilities like, because if they win that aggregation contract, then they know they've got those customers. Anyone who is covered can opt out, but most people don't, because you get a good price. The more people that are in an aggregation program, the more bargaining power there is, and the better of price you can get on this energy. So this program will roll out a lot of renewable energy at a good price and create jobs, clean our environment, and at the same time, the Columbus program is also going to be generating grants for low-income neighborhoods that will most likely be used for renewable energy or energy efficiency upgrades for residents and businesses.
Columbus already has a net metering programs where people can install solar panels, maybe in some places, small wind turbines, and build them out, and then, in fact, reduce their own utility bills. Did your RFP with the utility provider, it allowed for local energy and investment of that kind. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So people can still put solar panels on their houses. There is a car dealership on the north end of town that has a small wind turbine, and you can absolutely still do that in net metering. That's a state policy, and that is not affected. So people can still do that, and if they generate more energy than they're using, then that goes back onto the grid, and they can get paid for that.
In fact, although the contract is long-term, the city does negotiate the contract, and I suspect the contract can be changed. For example, if in fact the city and its residents thought that they would prefer changing the rates for a kilowatt hour, that is the payments, changing the percentage of it. Right now it's 0.1% that would go to the city that could be distributed to neighborhoods. But if they went to 0.3% or even 0.5%, that would be a considerable amount of money that could be used for alternative transport of all kinds, of reconstructing the city. Is that a long-term possibility for the Columbus program?
So the grants program that you mentioned, and like you said, it's 0.1 cents per kilowatt hour. That's what's being added to people's bills. So it ends up being, I don't know, $1 or something, maybe per month, depending on how much power they use. And then that money will be used for community grants. And that grants program is still a lot of it being worked out. A lot of people are really interested in, say, incentives for solar panels. We're also really interested in energy efficiency, and as Ready for 100, we are advocating for a lot of equity work. So, for example, many cities cope with what's called the split incentive because a lot of low-income people rent, and they rent very inefficient apartments, and they're the ones paying the utility bills, and their utility bills are too high. But it would be the landlords that have to make the upgrades, and they don't have the incentive to do that. So we want some of this money to be used to help, say, low-income apartments make some energy upgrades so people aren't spending as much on utilities and they have more money to spend on other necessities. Larger things like transit or other sustainable, especially big-ticket items, those probably would be elsewhere in the city budget. Columbus has a whole program about transportation called Smart Columbus. They're looking at transportation corridor planning through a program called Link Us, and they're working with the Transit Authority on that, mapping out what will be the main transit corridors where we want to do bus rapid transit or possibly light rail, and have the development concentrated along those corridors so they're not eating up farmland. So really, kind of what you're saying, moving to 100% renewable energy or really sustainability as a city is a whole city planning process. It touches every aspect of the city. And these grants from CCA will not likely be enough to cover, you know, those kinds of big ticket items. But that's something the city is talking about and working on separately. Because these are little amounts being added to people's utility bills, we don't want to add too much because we want to make sure that bulk purchase rate is actually a good rate without a bunch of add-ons and that people can still afford the renewable energy.
Yeah, there's also bond issues that cities could do, and if the people of this country decide to cut the military budget in half, well, we'd still be by far the most powerful military country in the world. And there are many other ways of raising that money. A huge infrastructure coming out of the Congress could, in fact, make Columbus, maybe even your Columbus senators, if they were promised several billion dollars to make, well, Cincinnati, that's come a long way, another Ohio city, and Columbus, and your city, Grove City, they could really reconstruct their cities, and there's no reason why not, and it would really help the Ohio economy. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Kathy Colin Becker, who spearheaded the takeover electricity supply responsibility for Columbus and Grove City, Ohio. In a red state, Grove City, a majority and determined conservative base. Trump did extremely well, but so did, in fact, the takeover of electricity by the city. It was quite a victory that no one expected. Kathy Becker, one final issue I feel is necessary to talk about. It's sort of speculative, but I invite you to speculate along with me. The question is, how do we get there? How do we use our resources, not just for our cities, but for the rest of the people in U.S. North America and the people around the world? This has to be actually an international effort, but the U.S. could clearly lead the way. It has the resources. Mm-hmm. It also has the planners and the scientists, and it has people like Mark Jacobson at Stanford, who has studied every state in the union and shown how nearly every county of this union has sufficient sun and wind power so that a huge grid is not required. The trillions of dollars that the utilities are talking about are not necessary. And it would also be more reliable. No grid system is any more reliable than its weakest pylon, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them that snake through sensitive environmental areas and across rivers and mountains, thousands of miles of grid that are all at risk. In any event, localities have tremendous capacities for organizing people in the neighborhoods and the city as a whole to do so many things. One of them is conserving energy and reducing energy use and creating this sort of democratic crusade of the kind that people were involved in during World War II, fighting Nazi Germany and Japan. It seems to me that's necessary if we are ever going to really reconstruct our economy and the way we live. There's a lot of discussion about all of those goals. How large is that discussion? To what extent can you really involve people so that they begin seeing the possibilities and the necessity of going to 100% renewable? And is it possible to get people to participate, thinking about their neighborhoods and how they could lower their use of energy and therefore the need for capital outlays to build new systems?
Right. So I can just speak from the point of view of the Ready for 100 campaign. So we have been working on this for the last 4 years or so, talking to the city, but also we did several public education, public outreach efforts. One was we launched a petition asking the city to move to 100% renewable energy, and we set a goal of getting 5,000 signatures on that petition. We did that in summer of 2019. We wouldn't have been able to do it during COVID in 2020, but in 2019, we tabled at dozens of community festivals and events, some small, some really big, and we got the 5,000 signatures on our petitions. Just getting those signatures gave us an opportunity to talk with people about renewable energy. You know, people love renewable energy, but they aren't sure it's possible. And letting them know, yes, this is possible. We have the technology. It's just a matter of finding a way to roll this out. And we've also done several film events and panel discussions and workshops and trainings. We did a program called Community Dialogues, and we especially looked at doing that in kind of low-income areas where people talk about what is the community they grew up in and what is the neighborhood like where they live now. If they could just construct their perfect neighborhood, what would that look like? Getting people to think about the neighborhood in the current state that it is in to more what they want it to look like. What kind of advocacy would they do? What kind of conversations would they have with their neighbors? We've done a lot over the last 4 years to just try to educate people in Columbus about renewable energy and sustainability and what does a truly sustainable and healthy community look like. Now, we've also been talking to the city about that. The city is now working on its climate action plan, which will be out sometime mid next year, and they created a stakeholder advisory group, which two of us from Ready for 100 at Columbus are on. So they've gone through a couple of iterations with some different ideas of sectors to work in and action goals to try to meet, and they've floated it in front of their advisory group, and we've provided feedback. In general, we think the goals are a little too low, and we want to encourage them to increase those goals. So this aggregation commitment is, or program, will be part of that overall sustainability effort. In Columbus, it will lower emissions by 1.2 million metric tons, which is somewhere between 11 and 19% of the total emissions of the city of Columbus, depending on how you count. You know, either way, it's a big program. It lowers emissions a lot, but still a long way to go. So we're talking to them about things like, you know, what I mentioned before with the split incentive. They've done a lot of home energy audits, but actually providing help for people to upgrade and make the energy upgrades to bring down energy use. I guess they passed an ordinance that requires large building owners to benchmark and measure their energy use. Well, we'd like to see them actually starting to get these large building owners to lower that energy use. If they're going to give out a tax break to a new development, and there are a lot of new developments in Central Ohio because a lot of people are moving here, require those buildings to be LEED certified or a plan to get to net zero. They are starting to move city fleets to electric. We'd like to see the bus fleet become electric. They are doing a lot to build out charging infrastructure and encourage citizens to drive more electric vehicles. Love to see the municipal utility roll out, say, community solar projects and solar resiliency hub. Most cities don't have a municipal utility, but some do, and some are using it to do some really creative things. Cincinnati has done a thing called the 2030 district, where the buildings in that district have pledged to drastically lower their energy use. We'd like to see solar panels on schools and community centers. We'd like to see a public green bank to finance a lot of these investments. Columbus is doing a really good job with what's called PACE financing, Property Assessed Clean Energy, which allows, mostly used for large buildings, to finance energy upgrades on the property taxes. And Columbus is getting ready to roll out a residential version of that. You know, the city is doing a lot of things. They're looking into a lot of things, and we're just kind of encouraging them to go further and maybe think of some new things, because the science says we need to cut our emissions in half by 2030, and we hope that the city of Columbus will be able to do that.
Kathy Collin Becker, really good talking to you, and keep up reaching into the neighborhoods and getting commitments and generating this public dedication to really changing how we do business in this country. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to both of you, Kathy Becker and Bill Resnick, also to Patricia Kohlberg and Alex Diamond earlier in the program. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay safe, stay active. Science, genius, girl.